You're listening to Lincoln and Presidential Campaign Politics. Dr. Silvana Sadali, Associate Professor of History at St. Louis University and author of From Property to Person, Slavery and the Confiscation Acts, 1861 to 1862, on the subject of Lincoln and the Constitution in Civil War era presidential politics.
All American elections, whether local, state, congressional, or presidential, are an expression of the will of the people. The United States Constitution created the framework of a representative democracy that gave its citizens that right. By casting their vote, the people support or rebuke the current administration, or they hope to influence future policy. Now, mind you, I'm certainly not saying that the voters always get what they want. At times, the electorate has been desperately disappointed by their representatives. And on the other hand, elected officials are frequently caught up in events beyond their control, so they're unable to fulfill their pledges. Campaign politics must always involve both sides of that equation, what the people want or don't want, and what elected officials are able to or not able to deliver. The Constitution plays a vital role in that equation, first, by creating and protecting the citizens' right to vote, and second, by structuring a government that is supposed to be responsive to the greater good of its citizenry. What I'd like to discuss today is the notion that presidential elections, particularly those of the Civil War era, are a referendum not only on campaign promises, but also on the future of the United States Constitution. These mid-19th century elections pass judgment on the Lincoln administration's decisions, and they also evaluated how political leaders interpreted or enforced the people's wishes. One of the ideas I'll suggest this evening is that democratic elections not only express the people's will, how they want to be governed and what they want their representatives to do, but also the longer-range future direction of their nation. In America, long-range future direction is, or ought to be, synonymous with the U.S. Constitution. And that has brought me to the subject of my talk this evening, the relationship between the presidential elections of the Civil War era and President Abraham Lincoln's power to influence the Constitution. I will argue that not only were these elections a referendum on constitutional interpretation, they actually shaped the future of the Constitution. In times of crisis, especially the calamity of civil warfare, a democracy questions its very foundations. The role of the Constitution becomes crucial. In other words, at those historic turning points, electoral platforms and campaign promises become fundamental constitutional questions. You see, for mid-19th century Americans, this was not just mere rhetoric. They really did worry that fundamental changes could destroy their Constitution, and that this was a question of the survival of the democratic experiment. I also want to emphasize that both North and South saw the problem this way, that is, as a constitutional crisis. They just came at it from opposite ends. So these elections can be seen as a vote on how the U.S. Constitution would be interpreted in the future. Many Northerners believed that secession was a fundamentally destructive act, indeed, a vote against the Constitution itself. Americans living during the era of the Civil War were just a generation or so away from the time of the nation's founding. They were still fearful that the Constitution might not survive. The 1860 and 1864 presidential elections were particularly poignant in this regard, since they raised fundamental issues concerning property rights and the powers of the federal government. In fact, I'll suggest that these issues did cause American citizens to question and debate the Constitution, which would make it possible for them to envision and later accept fundamental changes in the Constitution. Now, for a bit of background, presidential elections have affected constitutional interpretations in several ways. First, whether they should or not, presidents have taken constitutional interpretation into their own hands. For example, when Thomas Jefferson concluded the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, when Andrew Jackson decided to remove the Cherokee from their lands in direct contravention of a Supreme Court decision in the 1830s, and when Abraham Lincoln established the blockade and suspended the writ of habeas corpus in 1861. Second, presidents make Supreme Court appointments, and those change the direction of constitutional interpretations for generations. Finally, during the time of warfare, presidents often implement emergency measures that change the way we see our Constitution because they strengthen the power of the executive branch of government, usually permanently. These vital constitutional questions, the right of secession, the right to own human property, or to abolish the right to own human property. They frightened people precisely because they felt that the Constitution was both precious and fragile. I think we forget now that these questions forced Americans to confront the notion that their nation might not survive, or that the crisis might change their country so that its fundamental liberties would be destroyed. Therefore, the question of the influence of the Constitution on the presidential elections was of life or death importance to American voters. And one could say, as historian Philip Paladin suggested, that the Civil War itself was a test and a vindication of the U.S. Constitution. In order to illustrate this proposition, I'd like to take you through a quick tour of the great constitutional questions in the 1856, 1860, and 1864 presidential contests, and very briefly, the 1862 midterm elections. Though, of course, we have to admit that the greatest constitutional dilemma, whether we should or should not form a nation with slavery still at the heart of our system, was never resolved in the Constitutional Convention of 1787. And that, in fact, is what eventually brought our nation to the brink of self-destruction. The reason this became such a crisis is precisely because elections and legislatures couldn't take action on constitutional issues. Unlike other national governments, such as, for example, the British Parliament, American legislators did not possess the power to rid the nation of human bondage. That is, they had to await constitutional revision. The British Parliament passed the Slavery Abolition Act in 1833. Why couldn't Congress do the same? Because, first, American voters elected local and national representatives who would refuse to do so. And second, and much more significant, because our Constitution is sovereign to Congress and the President. Specifically, the Constitution protects human property, the right to own human property, just as it protects every other species of property. And until the Constitution itself was amended, no one, not Congress, not the President, could alter that fact. Theoretically, slavery could only be abolished within states. Even the most radical abolitionists recognized the scope of the problem, which is exactly why William Lloyd Garrison called the Constitution a covenant with death, and why he believed that elections could not affect the future of slavery. So now we're back at the topic of constitutions and elections. I do want to get us to Abraham Lincoln as quickly as possible. But in order to explain his story, I have to begin with the presidential election of 1856. That year, a new party, the Republican Party, fielded its first presidential candidate, John C. Fremont. It's safe to say that probably half the nation's voters considered him far too radical on the issue of slavery. The major issues of the 1856 campaign included, on the one hand, the extension of slavery into the new Western territories, and on the other, restraint of the so-called slave power, which is a rather paranoid term characterizing the Southern slave states' power in Congress and their control over national issues. Democrat James Buchanan won. He was a wily politician, but ultimately short-sighted enough to support a fraudulent pro-slavery constitution in the Kansas Territory, which fueled the Kansas-Missouri border violence. Still, the voters sent a signal to Congress and to the rest of the nation that they were interested in a conservative policy toward the sectional conflict. However, Republican candidate John C. Fremont took a more radical anti-slavery stance than called for in the Republican Party's platform. The fact that he could gain a third of the popular vote at a time when the nation was so divided is an indication that a significant number of voters were ready for a harder line on slavery. Still, remember, a Democrat won, and a conservative Democrat at that. The nation wasn't ready for that kind of radicalism after all. Americans were still hoping for moderation and compromise, which had so far seen them through every emergency. But in the meantime, an ambitious young Springfield lawyer was contemplating running for national office. In 1857, Abraham Lincoln spoke out against the dishonest pro-slavery constitution in Kansas and against the Dred Scott decision. The following year, he debated with Stephen A. Douglas on the point of slavery's expansion into the new Western territories. And that question proved to be the match to the fuse of a growing sectional conflict. Southern slave owners knew they were heading toward a make-or-break presidential election. The results of the 1856 election showed that if the new Republican Party had added only two states, Pennsylvania and Illinois, they would have won. The party platform took the hardest line against slavery of any of the major political parties. Moreover, its supporters included abolitionists and other radical reformers. In the 1860 presidential contest, the Republican platform explicitly called for the non-extension of slavery into the territories. Now, to modern Americans, this may seem moderate, but to antebellum slave owners, this appeared radical because it interpreted the Constitution as giving Congress power over the territories. In the rising conflict between free and slave states, the territories were vitally important. I think average Americans have forgotten that the primary concern in 1860 wasn't emancipation, it was slavery in the territories. This was the crucial question in the late 1850s right into the Civil War era, and that is precisely the constitutional question to which the voters were trying to respond and on which presidential candidates were attempting to reassure their constituents. Of course, this mounting tension had already created a volatile situation when John Brown launched his raid on Harper's Ferry on October 15, 1859, which exacerbated Southern fear and rage when Southern slave owners learned that the money to finance this raid had come from Northern abolitionists. They became convinced that all Republicans wanted to emancipate slaves and cause violent uprisings throughout the South. They vowed that if a Republican became president, they would secede. And that became the fundamental constitutional question in the 1860 contest, the nullification of a legal election and the right of a state to break off from the Union. So here are the two primary constitutional issues at play in the 1860 election. First, how much power does Congress, the legislative branch, and the president as the executive branch, have over local institutions? And second, if a government appears to be in conflict with the basic welfare of some of the people, do those citizens have a right to alter or abolish that government, as contemplated in the Declaration of Independence? In order to explore the mutual influence of the Constitution and elections, let's examine the 1860 election campaign issues in more detail. The Republican campaign platform called for a, quote, peaceful and constitutional triumph and demanded the, quote, maintenance of the principles promulgated in the Declaration of Independence and embodied in the Federal Constitution. Now, both Republicans and Democrats agreed that the laws of the nation had to be maintained. But the Republican campaign assurances that, quote, the rights of the states must be preserved must have sounded hollow after John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. And we know what happened next. Southern slaveholders were by now firmly convinced that a Republican victory in the upcoming presidential contest would inevitably lead to the abolition of slavery. They had lost their faith that they would be able to vote the administration out of office in the next election. It would be too late by then. They saw it as the end of government that could or would protect them. This demonstrates, to me, the breakdown of the constitutional order. It failed because some of its citizens no longer trusted that it would restrain a powerful government. So they chose instead to secede from the Union. And at this point, we have to leave the seceded states behind because they formed their own government, at least according to themselves. In fact, the Confederacy didn't actually have a regular presidential elections during its brief history. The secession crisis occurred during the lame duck period of Buchanan's administration. Buchanan was unwilling to coerce the Confederacy and in truth received very little support from the 36th Congress for even the smallest military force to safeguard military installations. The nation would have to wait until March for Lincoln's inauguration and until July 1861 for the arrival of the 37th Congress for any decisive action. Lincoln's view on the Constitution, especially during this emergency, can be summarized under two principles. First, perpetual union. According to Lincoln, the Union was inseparable, and the Constitution must be so construed as to be able to save the nation and safeguard a republican form of government for all citizens. And second, the primacy of human liberty. Most Lincoln biographers agree that Lincoln revered the Declaration of Independence above the Constitution. He considered the Constitution to be the frame of silver around the apple of gold of human liberty. That is, the Constitution was both valuable and beautiful, but ultimately a tool for the protection of a sacred truth. Lincoln's interpretation of human liberty conflicted with the more traditional view that valued property rights above human freedom. If we accept my hypothesis that democratic elections are a referendum on constitutional interpretation, then the best way to judge Lincoln's first term as president might be to examine the outcomes of the 1862 midterm elections. There were 185 congressional seats and two important state governorships at stake. Professor Weber has alluded to several of the constitutional issues that caused a public opinion furor during that early wartime period. I'll just refer to three. A week after Fort Sumter, April 26, 1861, Lincoln decided to blockade southern ports. According to international rules of warfare, the blockade was essentially a declaration of war because it recognized the Confederate States of America as a separate legal entity. Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus a day later, April 27th, in Maryland and in southern Indiana. Disloyal residents were giving aid and comfort to the enemy, and he instituted arbitrary sort of not within the courts, but arbitrary military arrests to deal with that. In 1863, of course, Lincoln would order the suspension of liberties all along the lines of battle. Wildly unpopular with Democrats, these actions interfered with basic liberties. When military officers jailed newspaper editors and confiscated editions of their papers, many Democrats became convinced that Lincoln was a tyrant who threatened their fundamental constitutional liberties. And if it's true that elections are an expression of the people's will, then public opinion plays a central role in the relationship between the Constitution and elections. Even though these events occurred before the mass media's involvement in political campaigns, highly partisan newspapers, often controlled by party leaders, kept the party flame burning bright and whipped up public sentiment for or against the administration's policies. And by 1862, those who had always opposed Lincoln and Republican policies were deeply angry. Add to that the fact that the war was not going well. Beginning with major defeats in 1861 and the grinding failure of the Peninsular Campaign in 1862, the Union Army was making little perceptible progress in retaking the seceded territory. Indeed, Secretary of State Henry Seward asked Lincoln to wait on his most controversial move, emancipation, until after a military victory. Because emancipation would interfere with private property rights, it would eventually require constitutional revision. Historian Michael Vornberg has observed that the Constitution had never been substantially amended in the period after the Bill of Rights and the Civil War. But what would have been nearly unthinkable before the outbreak of warfare, was now becoming a reality. Historian David Donald has also argued that it was not necessarily that Democrats gained so many votes, rather that Republicans lost them. They were dismayed by bloodshed and casualty rates and disgusted with what they perceived as soft war measures. Republicans stayed home from the polls and Democrats turned out. But between the end of 1862 and 1864, the tide of war slowly turned. In 1863, victories at Vicksburg and Gettysburg signaled a turn in the fortunes of war. And the Union Army captured control of the Mississippi River and of New Orleans. By late 1864, Sherman had captured Atlanta and begun his march to the sea. Those events turned not only the tide of war, but of public opinion as well. Meanwhile, Republicans still maintained control of Congress. Radicals now seemed less radical, and public opinion became more hard-bitten. What would be the fundamental constitutional questions in the election campaign of 1864? Considering the immense divisions in the North, let's begin with the problem of the loyal Democratic opposition. Democrats nominated General George B. McClellan, a man who had been the object of hero worship in the first 2 years of the war. He had built a competent army, was popular with his soldiers, and remained supremely confident in spite of his failures. However, he did not entirely support the so-called Chicago platform or the Democratic Party campaign policy. This platform embodied a plea for an immediate cessation of hostilities and a convention of all the states to negotiate peace. According to historian John Waugh, the Chicago platform alienated soldiers who still respected General McClellan but despised peace Democrats and copperheads. An editorial in the Republican newspaper, the New York Times, condemned the Democratic campaign platform as calling for, quote, absolute independence for the South and a hopeless and helpless surrender of the Union. The Times demanded that the Constitution be enforced by arms. Clearly, according to the Times, elections and politics by ordinary means had failed. Because a presidential election had been the impetus for secession, soldiers would now have to step in. To be fair, McClellan himself was hardly in favor of a negotiated peace, at least in public. He explicitly stated that the purpose of the war was to, quote, crush rebellion and to save our nation from the infinite evils of dismemberment. But that was not the message the soldiers heard, and they refused to vote for him. Even many Democratic soldiers decided to go for Lincoln instead. For his running mate in 1864, Lincoln chose Andrew Johnson of Tennessee. Lincoln and Johnson ran under the National Union platform. John C. Fremont was also in the race, at least until September, when he stepped aside as a result of a rather reprehensible brokered deal that involved the removal of a cabinet member. What would have happened had Fremont not dropped out? In early 1864, few expected that Lincoln could win re-election after all the bitter criticism of his policies, the military defeats, and the continual call for more men. Even Lincoln himself did not expect he could win. His campaign platform stressed the dangers of a potential Democrat victory, warning of imminent invasion, anarchy, despotism, and economic collapse. The first statement of the 1864 National Union campaign platform declared that it was the highest duty of all citizens to, quote, maintain against all their enemies the integrity of the Union and the paramount authority of the Constitution. The platform also insisted on unconditional surrender, upheld the abolition of slavery, and expressed gratitude to men serving in all branches of the military, and that is, of all men regardless of color. What also helped Lincoln significantly was the success, as I said, of Sherman's Atlanta campaign, as well as the fact that General Robert E. Lee was stalemated near Richmond in late 1864. And the soldiers, who represented a crucial new wartime constituency, also played a vital role. It had not escaped the notice of Republicans that soldiers who had voted in 1863 off-year congressional elections voted preponderantly Republican. Those soldiers whose states permitted absentee ballots could send in their votes. Others were furloughed home to vote. Lincoln personally wrote to generals asking them to allow soldiers to go home to vote in important state elections. And once again, Lincoln won a significant Electoral College victory. What does this victory in 1864 prove? I've argued that the Civil War election campaigns revolved principally around constitutional issues. Democratic campaigns stressed the fear that the Constitution was in danger from interference by the federal government. They worried that a tyrannical administration threatened fundamental liberties. On the other hand, Republicans emphasized that the Constitution had to be enforced in order to save the life of the nation. They had also become convinced that the Constitution would have to be amended in order to rid the nation of slavery. Abraham Lincoln won the election of 1864. Whether he did so because of or in spite of his controversial wartime policies may be open for discussion. Some of his decisions pushed the limits of constitutional protections to their very edge. The Emancipation Proclamation represented the first substantial revision of the Constitution and so prepared the nation for a willingness to contemplate a permanent revision. The fact that he won could be attributed to the people's readiness for a new vision of the Constitution. The 8 years from 1856 to 1864 brought shattering change to the American nation. The Constitution, nearly destroyed by a rebellion, emerged forever altered. These were the vital constitutional issues: the perpetuity of union, the power of the federal government to interfere with local institutions, and the sanctity of human rights. If, as I have argued, the presidential elections and the campaigns that brought them to fruition should be viewed as a referendum on how American voters wanted their representatives to interpret the Constitution, then I can leave you with this thought. In spite of their earlier resistance to any interference with slavery, and in spite of their fears that the Constitution might not survive fundamental change, Americans reelected the president who had proclaimed the end of slavery. Emancipation, requiring a constitutional amendment, reveals that the nation was ready to change. The rejection of McClellan and the vote for Abraham Lincoln in 1864 shows that a new nation was emerging, confident of perpetual union and the release of Americans from human bondage. Thank you.
Dr. Silvana Sadali, Associate Professor of History at St. Louis University.